Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri. In this series, I will be talking to academic staff about their research, their international networks, their aims, and plans for the future. I shall also be hearing from staff and students about the many events that take place here at the University of Malta. This is the program that keeps you informed about what's happening on campus. I'm very happy to have with me today in the studio Father Joseph Elul. Father Elul's area of specialization is Islamic thought as well as Christian-Muslim dialogue. And perhaps if I mention a few of the positions that he's held in the past and still holds today, it will put Father Elul in a context for our listeners. He is Archbishop's delegate for Christian-Muslim dialogue, founder editor of the religious cultural review Knesia El Fain, lecturer obviously in the Faculty of Theology and the Faculty of Arts in the Departments of Philosophy and Oriental Studies here at the University, professor in Caricatus in the Faculty of Theology at the Pontifical University of St. Thomas Aquinas in Rome, a visiting professor at the Pontifical Institute of Arabic and Islamic Studies, consultor to the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, and president of the Commission for Interreligious Dialogue of the Archdiocese of Malta. From that list, I think you can get an idea of what we're going to be talking about with Father Elul today. Welcome on the program.
Thank you very much for your offer.
Perhaps we can start off on a personal note. What triggered you really to take an interest in this particular area of theology, this idea of your interest in both religions?
The reason, I think, is both genetic and vocational. Well, you see, my paternal grandmother was born in Libya, in Tripoli. There was a sizable Maltese community in Tripoli at the turn of the century. So she was born there, and she lived in Tripoli together with her family right up to the age of 14. She lived in the old quarter of the city. I did visit it when I was there about 10 years ago. Then she came back to Malta. My father, before he married my mother, he worked in Libya too, for 3 years, between 48 and 51. My cousins on my mother's side were born in Libya. So I've got a good pedigree, so to speak, on as regards the genetic component. As regards the vocational, well, as a Dominican priest, Dominicans as such in their history have always had a history of encounters with Islam, both on the doctrinal level, on the level of living among Muslims, on the level of even apologetical writings, which are not necessarily polemical. In the history of the Dominican Order, we have, for example, people going to Iraq, like Ricoldo da Montecroce. Recently, middle of the 20th century, in Egypt, in Cairo, we have the establishment of the IDEO, the Institut Dominicain d'Etudes Orientales, which is one of the principal centers for academic research and dialogue between Christians and Muslims. So, I mean, my interest is also on the vocational side. I have to say that on a personal level, my interest in Islam began when I was doing my second year in theology. I chanced upon a book written by Dominican Jacques Jaumier, who was in Cairo, actually. It was entitled The Bible and the Quran, and that simply was the beginning of
the catalyst.
Yes, the catalyst that brought things where they are today.
as you've said, the discussion, the interreligious discussion between Islam and Christianity has been going on obviously for centuries. Your interest is clearly theological. It's an interest, you have a research interest. I'm saying that because obviously your interest is not political.
No.
However, one cannot ignore the political or the situation in society at the present time. So perhaps this is an important moment for this kind of discussion to be going on at all.
Indeed it is. In fact, I think that this trend, political, religious trend, has been going on for quite some time, maybe even before 9/11 itself. However, of course, it came to a head then. Unfortunately, this problem, this phenomenon, has been interpreted in many ways, but unfortunately it has not got into the heart of the situation. For example, we use terms of phrase that are political, that are ideological as regards religion. For example, when we speak of religion in terms of conservative, liberal, hardline, radical, I mean, moderate, I mean, these go down well in a political environment, but with religion, I mean, they make no sense. I mean, after all, religion has to do with God, as far as I know. And I think that we need, first of all, to understand religion by going back to the meaning of religious terms instead of interpreting them in a political key. And I mean, the problem is that with a secular society that is becoming increasingly secular and a-religious, if not anti-religious, the problem is increasing rather than decreasing. Of course, on the other hand, we do have the problem of a certain entrenchment on the part of some Muslim movements, especially in Europe, but not only. Let me give you an example. I do remember that 9/11 occurred. Immediately, the newspapers came out with articles saying, well, this has already been envisaged in Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations.
A famous phrase,
which, I mean, was also a gross misinterpretation of Huntington. I mean, Huntington did not speak simply of Islam. He also spoke of China, for that matter. But anyway. However, what I do believe is that the underlying threat facing modern societies today, especially European societies, is not that of a clash of civilizations. It is rather a confrontation between a secularism, and I'm speaking of secularism, not secularity, of a secularism that is being transformed into a religion, and an Islam that is being increasingly portrayed as an ideology.
When you are in the lecture room with your students,
yes,
and you're putting across these ideas, do you think that they are receptive to this idea, or have young people today really been heavily influenced by this, you know, in inverted commas, clash of civilizations idea?
Well, you would find students who would have this idea of clash of civilizations. However, I do try to help them think, or rather rethink, their ideas. After all, I make it very clear to them that my role is not simply that of teaching anything Islamic. They can I can give them a bibliography. They can read it. There's no problem. But to help them think and rethink some of their ideas, and to reconsider some of their stances as regards interreligious relations, dialogue with Islam, what Islam really is. So, on the one hand, you would find people who would rather remain in that area of a clash of civilizations. But there are others who are more receptive, and you notice that through the questions that they ask. Immediately, for example, as soon as I give them this idea that it's a clash between the secularism that is being transformed into religion and Islam that is being increasingly portrayed as an ideology, the first question that they ask, and thank God they ask that question, is why? What do you mean by
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And that helps immensely to create a lively discussion. After all, that is the role of a university class.
Exactly. I was going to say, why is the big university question?
Exactly.
Isn't it? You can't really blame them, because putting aside the present day sort of conflict idea, the historiography of the relationship between the Christianity and Islam has not been portrayed in a terribly happy manner over the years.
Yes, so it is inbuilt, but unfortunately it is inbuilt because we have a very distorted idea of the past. Let me give you an example. In simple terms, maybe even crude terms, one thinks of the history of Christian-Muslim relations that in terms of: before Vatican II, we were at each other's throats. After Vatican II, we started being nice to each other and patting each other on the back. That is not exactly the way history goes. I mean, fine, there were battles, there were wars, there were writings that were quite insulting, both on the Christian side and the Muslim side. But there were other things. I mean, when you think that the medieval period, for example, the period when you had such a denigration of Islam among Christian apologists, was the same period when people like Thomas Aquinas were absorbing Islamic thought, Islamic philosophy, Avicenna, Averroes, into their writings. I mean, that is no mean achievement. And here we're speaking of the medieval period, which is many times portrayed as if it were superstitious, dark, obtuse, etc. So, I mean, it's not only the battlefield. There were other things. And, I mean, even when we come to Vatican II, I mean, there was a preparation for that. There was the experience of Christian communities living in Muslim countries. And again, unfortunately, there is this idea that we identify Christianity with the West. There are Eastern Christians. There are about 14 million Christians living in the Arab world. I mean, Christianity is not simply Latin Christendom. It's also Eastern Christianity. These people are also Christians.
My history classes, I can still vaguely remember my history classes.
Yes.
I don't remember Avicenna ever being
mentioned at all.
Or the glory of Arab scientists in general.
Precisely. So what we know is simply this, how would you call it, Ivanhoe idea of Christian-Muslim relations and the past.
There are these glorious tenets of the Christian faith, which you know, the idea of equality, that everyone's born the same, and these. What are the great tenets, do you think, of the Islamic religion?
One could speak of Islam even in a comparative way with Christianity. After all, the idea that Islam, just as with Christianity and Judaism, is monotheistic, is already lays the groundwork for much that is beautiful in the religion. First and foremost, the idea of believing in one God, you already know that everything that results from belief in one God is going to influence society in a positive way. Because, I mean, having only one center, you have a certain harmony in society. Again, the belief in one God, just as with Christianity, means also that there is, that this idea of oneness in society, harmony in society, also brings out the idea of solidarity. And therefore, just as with the biblical tradition, in the biblical tradition you have care for the widow, for the orphan, for the poor, the same. You have the same thing in Islam, after all. Again, the idea of pilgrimage, which is a very deeply felt practice in Islam. I mean, what does pilgrimage mean? It has a twofold meaning. First, going back to one's roots, and secondly, to revive one's religious faith. So you have this idea of belief in one God. You have the idea of solidarity. You have this idea of pilgrimage, the idea of nearness to God. From these, you have the whole resulting ambiance of Islam and what it means to the Muslim. Of course, Islam has its connections. There are parallels with Christianity and with Judaism, naturally. And for this reason, as a Christian, one can obviously notice with admiration the way Muslims practice their faith. The way they submit to the one God, just as with the Christian tradition, you have the idea of the oneness of God during the celebration of the Eucharist, during the Lenten season, etc. I mean, you find these parallels, which help Christians, or rather place Christians in a better position to understand Islam if given the right perspective.
One of the things which I think people are just sort of starting now to understand a little bit more is the different perhaps factions is a derogatory expression, sections or areas of Islam. I mean, before we used to talk about Islam, full stop.
Yeah.
And now perhaps we're beginning to understand that Islam is made up of various different
groups,
religious
communities.
Yes. So now we're beginning to understand that a little bit better, in the same way that, after all, the Christian Church. Because some people tell me, but you know, we have one, the Christians have one head. Well, yes, the Catholic Church has one head, but Christianity is even wider than that.
But even within Catholicism itself, I mean, you know, there is such a thing as enculturation, after all. I mean, Catholicism is not European. If we believe that Catholicism, if we go to the roots of the term Catholicism, which means universal, therefore it is universal, and it means that it embraces different cultures and it accepts and it works within different cultures. The same thing with Islam. I mean, remember when I just said that you have the idea of Islam increasingly portrayed as an ideology? Just as with Christianity, I mean, Christianity is not homogenous, nor is Islam. I mean, Islam is practiced in Saudi Arabia, it's not Islam practiced in the deserts of North Africa or in sub-Saharan Africa. Even though, unfortunately, there is this trend among some Muslim factions that have infiltrated into sub-Saharan Africa of giving this idea that there is a standard Muslim male and a standard Muslim female, and the code of conduct has to be uniform. That kills religion. I mean, if you go, for example, to sub-Saharan Africa, you cannot help admire the way Islam has enculturated itself, even in architecture. I mean, you go everywhere today in Europe, the mosques are almost standard. They are a copy of a Turkish mosque. That's not an idea of enculturation, whereas if you go to sub-Saharan Africa, you find that the Islam has been very much, has entered into the fabric of that culture. And that is why you also have mystical communities, communities of mystics, Sufis, the Sufi tradition in North Africa and sub-Saharan Africa, just as you find it in Iraq and even in the Balkans, for example. Even here, as I said, Islam is not homogenous. Of course, you have the common principles of belief and common principles of practice. That's obvious enough. I mean, any religion needs to have a certain core beliefs and core mode of conduct. But then, how these are worked out in the day-to-day life, it depends on the culture of the place.
Turning to Malta, because Malta's an interesting place
indeed,
vis-a-vis, in general anyway, but really in this context, because
yes,
we had the Arabs were here,
yes,
for some time.
Yeah, for more than 200 years, actually, from
exactly
870 till, I mean,
officially till 1214.
They were rulers from 870 yes till 1090, but then right up to the middle of the 13th century, for sure, there was still a Muslim presence.
I remember Father Peter Zerginenglot once telling me there are certain things which have remained from that time,
yes,
deeply inculcated, deeply embedded into the Maltese psyche.
Yeah.
And he used to quote the expression in Malta, you may not agree with him, in Malta where we tend to say Miktubalik.
Maktub. Yes.
Something
yes
which is,
yes.
You know, it was written in his destiny.
Uh-huh. We have
Arab
many concepts
period
that have found them, you know, have been embedded in Maltese society. In fact, my colleague, in a sense, my mentor, in many ways, Dr. Martin Zamit, he gave a very interesting conference just a few weeks ago regarding religious terms, Muslim and Christian, that have found their way into the Maltese language. And it's very, very interesting. He spoke of Arab terms that are strictly Muslim, Arab terms that are Christian. Because, I mean, there was a contact with Arab Christianity, even in Malta. I mean, Christians from the Middle East, etc. So it's true enough.
Also, Malta, with its geographical position, being monotheistic,
yes,
Christianity very strong on the island, and yet looking east and south. A lot has been said by politicians and non about the idea that Malta is a good place where this dialogue can take place. And I know that on courses here, there's a lovely course, the Human Rights and Democratization course, where they get people from troubled areas in the military, and they come here. And we actually managed to get Israelis sitting down in the same room as their counterparts, their student peers from North African countries. Because they feel at home within a monotheistic mindset, but also the language, as we were saying, they don't find it a threatening environment.
No.
Do you think this is just words, or do you think this is a real?
It is a real phenomenon.
Feeling.
However, one must also be careful, because Malta is changing rapidly. Maltese society is changing rapidly. So, although they might feel at home, because, I mean, even the culture of the place, the fact that we express ourselves in a Semitic language, I mean, that is going to remain. Although we are already receiving much, or accepting much, from Romance languages, and they're entering too quickly into Maltese jargon. But on the other hand, Maltese society is changing at a very fast pace. I think that here we have to keep in mind that Malta, being an island and at the same time being at the crossroads, places it in an enviable position on the one hand and in an unenviable position on the other. At the enviable position because it can be at the crossroads of dialogue between cultures, especially Mediterranean cultures, yes. But on the other hand, we have to keep in mind that we are living between two time frames. We are just beginning to absorb what European society has gone through in the 70s and the 80s. But, with the changes in legislation, etc. On the other hand, I mean, we are in an era of globalization. And that means that through the internet, through going abroad, communications, etc., radio, TV programs, etc. I mean, we find ourselves plummeting into the 21st century. Malta is still very much a society in constant flux. So, yes, it's true they find themselves at home here, but on the other hand, one must be aware that Maltese society is changing rapidly.
Well, we've come to the end of our time. Thank you very much, Father Joseph Elul, for coming to talk to us on this very, very topical subject. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us on University Matters. You can listen to any of the previous interviews in this series on the Campus FM website. I hope you'll join us again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.